This is August 12th, 2018, and I'm going to talk today about causation, the law of cause and effect, and how we see it at work in the microbiome. First, about causation. This is one of the foundations of Buddhist doctrine, which really means aspects of the truth. That's what the Dharma means. I am trying to remember to use the word Dharma more than Buddhism, because Buddhism, the word Buddhism, didn't come about until something like the 19th century or the 20th century. Before that, in all the Buddhist countries, what we now call Buddhist countries in Asia, it was just referred to the Dharma, the truth, the law, the way. People, I suppose, may raise an eyebrow and say, well, that's what every religion says. They say it's the way, it's the truth. But here we have a lot of science, like the whole body of science, to back us up with this. And one of the most basic features of science is causation, cause and effect. So, speaking from perspective of Zen Buddhism, everything, all phenomena are cause and effect, causation. Each one of us is causation in process. Each one of us is the effect of previous causes and conditions, and also the cause of subsequent causes and conditions, effects, which are causes and conditions. We just, in the Hakuin chant that we just recited, there's a line, now the gateway to the oneness of cause and effect is thrown open, seeing that ultimately there's no before and after exactly, in the ultimate sense, that each one of us right now is effect and cause, and everything is effect and cause. This is the effect of causes, the stick, the platform, raising my hand, raising my arm. It's the effect of causes, and itself is the cause of other effects. Sound, starting with sound. But it's more a little more sophisticated than just a linear idea, just cause and effect in one straight line. Every effect has primary and secondary causes and conditions. The classic example, which is such a good one, I think, is that a plant is the effect of causes and conditions. The primary cause is the seed, which, however, itself is an effect of previous causes. But anyway, the primary cause is the seed, and then the secondary causes or conditions is the soil, the water it needs, and the sun. Each one of us is here. The primary cause is the union of egg and semen from our parents. And then there are all the secondary causes and conditions, our upbringing, all the supports and the whole milieu of growing up. There's more coverage these days of the infections that are spreading, that are coming from ticks and mosquitoes, and the causes there, that the causes are several. There's the warmer weather, expanded human travel, suburban reforestation, and a dearth of new vaccines. This list jotted down from an article I read this weekend about the spreading of these infections from ticks and mosquitoes and fleas. And there are about a billion other examples anyone can come up with of how this causation, this law of cause and effect, is underlies everything. It gets still more sophisticated, though, even than primary and secondary causes, and that is that everything is co-arises with everything else. All physical things, mental things, exist in a web of mutual causal interaction. There's nothing that exists apart from every other thing. So there's no such thing as a teacher apart from a student. You just can understand this just semantically. Teacher and student co-arise. Coach and player, or coach and athlete, co-arise. Employer and employee co-arise. So you take one away, then the other makes no sense. It's meaningless. So just as each one of us is, right now, cause and effect in process, all of us together are cause and effect in process. All of us together, including people who are hearing this by live streaming. So it's just another word, causation. Cause and effect is another word for here, now. Everything else is thoughts. Causes and conditions are embedded in this very moment, this existence. But everything is dynamically interdependent. The example the Buddha used for this is bundles of reeds. Think of farming in a field. Bundles of reeds leaning against one another. You can't say that one is supporting the others more than any of the others are. Maybe it's a little even clearer when you have two bundles of reeds leaning against one another. They co-arise. They're there in mutual dependence on one another. And so it is with us, with one another, in society, and everything. The fashion industry, the designers are co-arise, dependently co-arise with the consumers or the critics. Today, in about an hour or so, we're doing a memorial service for Cynthia Seafeld. So she was on my mind this morning. She she had a cognitive decline in her later years that became quite serious. She had to leave staff and go to a assisted living facility in Milwaukee because of a rare form of dementia, I was told. It came on very, very gradually. She became disoriented and even started getting disoriented in the Keen-Heen line. And spatial. It's a spatial kind of form of dementia that, of course, became worse and worse. But that too, that condition is the effect of various causes and conditions working together. All of them came together in that condition. And when I say condition, or even any effect of a cause, of a previous cause, this again means a process. It's nothing fixed. Everything is in process. Everything is in flux. And so that condition itself changed over time. Dependent co-arising. It's so easy to blame our elected officials, our presidents and other elected officials, but they wouldn't have reached office without voters. They co-arise. Their position co-arises with voters. And voters as maybe you could say the primary cause. But the voters in the soil, going back to that example, in the soil of the social milieu and social changes, all of those things gather together to affect voters who then go to the polls and elect our officials. So a more enlightened way to understand any political official leaders, if we don't like, is that they're only there because of so many others. Not as many as voted for Hillary Clinton, but still a lot of others. And leaders, our political leaders, mirror our greeds. Voters don't want to give up anything. And so leaders don't ask us to. They conspire. The leaders and voters conspire to wreak the havoc that we're seeing gathering over the last few years and decades. But this is also about power. Let's go back to teacher and student, and the idea of value and power. There can't be a good or bad teacher in the abstract. They don't exist without the student. There can't be a good or bad student in the abstract. They can't exist without the teacher. And the power is inherent not in either one of them exclusively, but in the relationship. And so it is with presidents and voters. The power is in the relationship between entities. So everything is a dynamically interdependent process. Everything is in process. Each one of us and everything. And the whole idea of inside and outside, or even identity, starts to break down, especially when you go to science and consider the microbiome. And that brings me to the book, this enthralling science book called, the title is I Contain Multitudes. It's from a line of Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass. He says, I contain multitudes. Walt Whitman could possibly have been an enlightened man, There's no way to ever know, but much of his writing has this awareness of the interdependence of everything, and everything in flux, everything in process. The title here is I Contain Multitudes, and the subtitle is The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life. And this is by an Ed Yong, Y-O-N-G. The book jacket tells us here that he's an award-winning science writer on the staff of The Atlantic. His blog, Not Exactly Rocket Science, is hosted by National Geographic, and his work has appeared in The New Yorker, Wired, The New York Times, Nature, New Scientist, Scientific American, The Guardian, The Times, Discover, Slate, and other publications. He divides his time between London and Washington. This book became a New York Times bestseller, and I just read it with the eye of Dharma, because it is pure Dharma. It's everything. It just confirms the Buddhist teaching from 2,500 years ago of dependent co-arising, interdependence, no self. I find that when I get into a book that I suspect I'll be using in Taisho, I make my own little index in the inside cover, and just to tempt people who haven't read this to give it a look, here are some of the things in my little handwritten index. Individuality, interdependence, metagenomics, the immune system, autism, schizophrenia, probiotics, alcohol, cancer, mucus, viruses, don't laugh, wait till you hear, mucus, breast milk, coral, malnutrition and obesity, pets, we'll get to that, C-sections, fiber, antibiotics, inherited microbes, and so forth. But we're going to start with the Buddhist teaching of no self, no independent, substantial, permanent self. Self-identity. But first, a little bit more about the microbiome. Microbiome basically means a collection of microbes, microbiota. He uses the clever phrase, he says, all of us have an abundant microscopic menagerie, collectively known as the microbiota or microbiome. They live on our surface, inside our bodies, and sometimes inside our very cells. The vast majority of them are bacteria. How many is something like they estimate that there are 100 trillion of them in our bodies. In fact, what really caught my eye about this whole idea of the microbiome was that is that microbiologists estimate that 90% of our cells are not our genes. We're the hosts. 10% is the host, and the guests are these trillions, hundreds of trillions of microbes. The vast majority of them are bacteria, but there are also other tiny organisms, including fungi, such as yeasts. There are viruses, too, in unfathomable numbers. A virome that infects all the other microbes and occasionally the host's cells. So all of this is symbiosis, different organisms living together. The whole notion of identity, which is raging all around us, gender identity, racial identity, ethnic identity, political identity, national identity, class identity, really acquires a whole different slant to it when we consider that most of our bodies are not us, genetically speaking. Most, 90, maybe 90%. He asks, knowing what we know, how do we even define an individual? If you define an individual anatomically as the owner of a particular body, then you must acknowledge that microbes share the same space. You could try for a developmental definition in which an individual is everything that grows from a single fertilized egg, but that doesn't work either because several animals, from squids to mice to zebrafish, build their bodies using instructions encoded by both their genes and their microbes. In a sterile bubble, they wouldn't grow up normally. You could try a physiological definition in which the individual is composed of parts, tissues and organs that cooperate for the good of the whole. Sure, but what about insects, in which bacterial and host enzymes work together to manufacture essential nutrients? Those microbes are absolutely part of the whole and an indispensable part at that. A genetic definition in which an individual consists of cells that share the same genome runs into the same problem. No matter how we squint at the problem, it is clear that microbes subvert our notions of individuality. They shape it too. Your genome is largely the same as mine, but our microbiomes can be very different, and our viromes even more so. So we could say a better word, if we could go back and talk to Walt Whitman, we might suggest that instead of saying, I contain multitudes, I am multitudes. Marvelous. Each one of us, multitudes. And then he acknowledges that these concepts can be deeply disconcerting. Independence, free will, and identity are central to our lives. Microbiome pioneer David Relman once noted that loss of a sense of self-identity, delusions of self-identity, and experiences of alien control all are potential signs of mental illness. Small wonder that recent studies of symbiosis have engendered substantial interest and attention. But he added that such studies highlight the beauty in biology. We are social creatures and seek to understand our connection to other living entities. Symbioses are the ultimate examples of success through collaboration and the powerful benefits of intimate relationships. And some more here. In reality, bacteria exist along a continuum of lifestyles between so-called bad parasites and good, these words, bad and good are in quotation marks, and good mutualists. Some microbes slide from one end of the parasite mutualist spectrum to the other, depending on the strain and on the host they find themselves in. But many exist at both ends of the continuum at once. The stomach bacterium Helicobacter pylori causes ulcers and stomach cancer, but also protects against esophageal cancer. And it's the same strains that account for both these pros and cons. Others can change roles in the same hosts, depending on the context. All of this means that labels like mutualist, pathogen, or parasite don't quite work as badges of fixed identity. These terms are more like states of being, like hungry, or awake, or alive, or behaviors like cooperating or fighting. They're adjectives and verbs rather than nouns. They describe how two partners relate to one another at a given time and place. And this is pure dharma, because each one of us is a verb. We think of ourselves as fixed entities and static entities, but because we are forever in flux, we can say we're verbs. In the Hopi language, a lot of what we consider nouns, they render as verbs. Like, not the altar, which I'm facing, not the altar, but they would call it altering. Not the plant, but planting. Not Fred, but fretting. And he says, we humans are also infected by pathogens that create holes in our guts, and we also get sepsis when our usual gut microbes cross into our bloodstream. As in caterpillars, the same microbes can be good in the gut, but dangerous in the blood. They're only mutualists by virtue of where they live. The same principles apply to so-called opportunistic bacteria that live in our bodies. They are normally harmless, but they can cause life-threatening infections in people whose immune system is weakened. It's all about the immune system. So the world of symbiosis is one in which our allies can disappoint us and our enemies can rally to our side. It's a world where mutualisms shatter for the matter of a few millimeters. Why are these relationships so tenuous? Why do microbes so easily slide between pathogen and mutualist? Mutualist always means it's a mutual benefit to the host and the guest. For a start, these roles are not as contradictory as you might imagine. Think about what a friendly gut microbe needs to set up a stable relationship with its host. It must survive in the gut, anchor itself so it doesn't get swept away, and interact with its host's cells. These are all things that pathogens must do too. So both characters, mutualists and pathogens, heroes and villains, often use the same molecules for the same purposes. Some of these molecules get saddled with negative names, like virulence factors, because they were first discovered in the context of disease, but they are inherently neutral. They're just like tools, like computers, pens, knives. They can be used to do wonderful things and terrible things. So, just to remind people, this means no, there's no self-identity. It all depends on function. There's no inherent, fixed nature to anything, to anyone. And we're seeing a rather remarkable example of it in one tiny corner of science in the natural world. He talks about lures, insects and microbes, flies that give off lures. He says the natural world is full of these inadvertent lures. You are giving some off right now. Certain bacteria can even turn their owners into magnets for malarial mosquitoes, while others put off the little bloodsuckers. Ever wonder why two people can walk through a midge-filled forest? Let's make it a tick-filled forest. And one emerge with dozens of welts while the other just has a smile? Your microbes are part of the answer. So he said, even when symbionts, those who we carry around who benefit from us, they don't come for, and benefit us, don't come for free. I guess it's a kind of a form of mutualist. Microbe. Even when they help their hosts, they create vulnerabilities. They need to be fed, housed, and transmitted, all of which costs energy. And most importantly, like every other organism, they have their own interests, which often clash with those of their hosts. if a maternally inherited symbiont like Wolbachia did away with males, it would get more hosts in the short term at the risk of driving those hosts extinct in the long term. If a few of a bobtail squid's bacteria stopped glowing, they would save on energy, but if enough of them went dark, the squid would lose its protective glow and the whole alliance would be swallowed by a watchful predator. If my gut microbes suppressed my immune system, they would grow more readily, but I would get sick. So just amazing. This fine line, this razor's edge, that not just that we're carrying with us, that we are, each one of us is this delicate balance of stuff. He says almost every major partnership in the world, in the natural world, is like this. Cheats are always a problem. Betrayal lurks perpetually on the horizon. Couples might work well together, but if one partner can get the same benefits without spending as much energy or effort, it will do so unless punished or policed. H.G. Wells wrote about this in 1930. Every symbiosis is, in its degree, underlain with hostility, and only by proper regulation and often elaborate adjustment can the state of mutual benefit be maintained. Even in human affairs, the partnerships for mutual benefit are not so easily kept up. In spite of me being endowed with intelligence and so being able to grasp the meaning of such a relation. But in lower organisms, there is no such comprehension to help keep the relationship going. Mutual partnerships are adaptations as blindly entered into and as unconsciously brought about as any others. These principles are easy to forget. We like our black and white narratives with clear heroes and villains. In the last few years, I've seen the viewpoint that all bacteria must be killed. Slowly, that narrative slowly give ground to, quote, bacteria are our friends and want to help us, even though the latter is just as wrong as the former. We cannot simply assume that a particular microbe is good just because it lives inside us. Even scientists forget this. The very term symbiosis has been twisted so its original neutral meaning, living together, has been infused with positive spin and almost flaky connotations of cooperation and harmony. But evolution doesn't work that way. It doesn't necessarily favor cooperation, even if that's in everyone's interests. And it saddles even the most harmonious relationships with conflict. Anyone thinking marriage? Business partners? And here's, he quotes a biologist, an evolutionary biologist, says, we need to separate important from harmonious. The microbiome is incredibly important, but it doesn't mean that it's harmonious. A well-functioning partnership could easily be seen as a case of reciprocal exploitation. Both partners may benefit, but there's this inherent tension. Symbiosis is conflict. Conflict that can never be totally resolved. It's one of the things that those of us who are married have to be watchful about, is that we're not, we don't have this mutual pact, unspoken, maybe unconscious mutual pact, that we're going to preserve each other's afflictions or blind spots. For the sake of harmony, that may be the best thing. But for the sake of growth or evolution, it's incumbent on us to point out as skillfully as possible when we feel that our partner is missing something or hurting himself or herself through some habit force. It's part of what love means. Pointing things out when the timing is important and the way it's done is important. But we owe it to one another to help in that way. This is really, from a Buddhist perspective, a Dharma perspective, this is really the whole point of marriage, is in this relationship of trust to offer up whatever we can to help the other and expect the other to do the same for us. And he says this inherent tension can never be totally resolved, but it can be managed and stabilized. How can the selfish interests of individuals be overcome to form cooperative groups? How, in other words, do I contain my multitudes? Where practice comes in, of course, practice where it teaches us to let go, to open up, and above all, to be aware of our reactive patterns. Here's a little nugget. The average human swallows around 1 million microbes in every gram of food they eat. Here's another example in the microscopic level of dependent co-arising parasites offer another possible route into the body. Many wasps lay their eggs in the bodies of other insects via sharp tubes that they plunge into victim after victim. In doing so, the wasps act as living, flying, dirty needles, spreading potentially beneficial microbes from one host to another, just as a mosquito's snout might spread malaria or dengue fever. We know that events like this happen because scientists have actually witnessed them in the field and reproduced them in the lab. Contaminated food and water, unprotected sex, dirty needles, these are all routes that we associate with disease. But any road that a pathogen can travel down is one that beneficial symbionts can also use to reach new hosts. By getting on with their usual activities in a purely selfish way, they incidentally benefit their hosts. These byproduct mutualisms are the perfect first handshake. And then a little more here. Richard Dawkins, in his book The Extended Phenotype, introduces the idea that an animal's genes, that is, its genotype, do more than sculpt its body, its phenotype. They also indirectly shape the animal's environment. Here we get back to dependent co-arising. Beaver genes build beaver bodies, but since those bodies go on to make dams, the genes are also redirecting the flow of rivers. A bird's genes create a bird, but they also make a nest. My genes made my eyes, hands, and brain, and in doing so, they also made this book. Here's the great web of interdependence and mutual causality. All of these things, dams, nests, and books, are what Dawkins called extended phenotypes. They are products of a creature's genes that extend beyond its body. In a way, that's what our microbiomes are. They too are shaped by animal genes, which create environments that encourage specific microbes to grow. Although they lie inside their owners, they are just as much an extended phenotype as a beaver dam. That is, these microbes. But even this comparison doesn't entirely work, because microbes, unlike the dam or this book, are themselves alive. They have their own genes, some of which are important or essential to their hosts. They aren't just extensions of a host's genome any more than the host is an extension of the microbe's genomes. So, argue some scientists, maybe it makes no sense to conceptually separate them. If animals are picky about their microbes, and microbes are picky about their hosts, and both are locked in partnerships that endure through generations, maybe it makes more sense to think of them as unified entities. Maybe we should think of them as one. And then I'm just going to end here with a nod to Human's Best Friend. I almost left this out, but Archie insisted that I read this. For those of you who may be far afield, Archie is our kind of our Zen Center mascot here. Pauline's dog spends a lot of time here. He talks about the effort, the well-intentioned effort on the part of parents in recent years to isolate their children from bacteria. And that these beneficial bacteria are taking the loss of them is taking a toll on us. The hypothesis as it now stands contends that children in developed countries no longer run the gauntlet of infectious diseases that they used to, and so grow up with inexperienced, jumpy immune systems. They are healthier in the short term, but they launch panicked immune responses to harmless triggers like pollen. This concept delineated an unenviable trade-off between infectious and allergic disease, as if we were destined to suffer one or the other. Later versions of the hygiene hypothesis shifted the emphasis away from pathogens and more towards benevolent microbes that educate our immune systems, or environmental species that lurk in mud and dust, and even parasites that establish long-lasting but tolerable infections. They have been christened old friends. They have been part of our lives throughout our evolutionary history, but their tenure has become shakier of late. And here, their disappearance isn't just due to stricter personal cleanliness, as the word hygiene unhelpfully implies. It's also due to the various trappings of urbanization. Smaller families, a move from muddy countryside to concrete cities, a preference for chlorinated water and sanitized food, and a growing distance from livestock, pets, and other animals. All of these changes have been consistently linked to a higher risk of allergic and inflammatory diseases, and all of them reduce the range of microbes that we are exposed to. A single dog, like Archie, can have a huge effect. When so-and-so hoovered up the dust of 16 homes, she found that those without furry pets were microbial deserts. Those with cats were far richer in microbes, and those with dogs were richer still. It turned out that man's best friend is a chauffeur for man's old friends. And then he goes on to say, our pets, even pets, are not our most important sources of old microbial friends. That honor goes to our mothers. And then he talks about natural childbirth, vaginal birth, and breast milk, and so forth. But our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless divine essence. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way.